DW Deutsche Welle. Worldlink.
Hello and welcome to DW's Worldlink, bringing you the personal stories behind the headlines. In Bonn, I'm Neil King.
And I'm Samantha Early.
As Russia moves to annex the Crimea, we hear how Moscovites feel about the standoff their country has triggered with the West.
Then why more and more Jews in France are packing their bags for Israel.
When the teacher speaks about the Shoah in class, a lot of pupils from Arab descent are not happy and make some derogatory remarks. So in certain parts of France, it is difficult to be Jew.
And we'll be introducing you to a man who's determined to wrest Istanbul from Erdogan's ruling AK party in local elections.
All these stories and more coming up on Worldlink.
You're listening to DW's Worldlink. In Bonn, I'm Neil King.
And I'm Samantha Early.
Russia's military aggression in Ukraine is in blatant breach of its international commitments, and it is a violation of Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. The annexation of Crimea through a so-called referendum held at gunpoint is illegal and illegitimate.
NATO chief Anders Fogh Rasmussen finding some frank words for Russia during a speech he gave in Washington earlier this week. Rasmussen's comments came a day after Russian President Vladimir Putin signed a treaty to annex the Crimean Peninsula following a controversial referendum in which the vast majority of Crimeans voted to join Russia and break with Ukraine. The West has responded with sanctions and threatened further punitive measures targeting Russia's economy if the Kremlin goes ahead with its plans.
And Moscow is indeed pressing on with the fast-track annexation of the strategically important Black Sea region, introducing the Russian currency and time zone and also handing out Russian passports. But how do Russians in the motherland feel about the annexation and the standoff it has triggered with the West? That's one of the questions we put to our Moscow correspondent, Gertrud Kerkamp, who's been covering the crisis from both Crimea and Russia.
They don't seem to be worried at all, I'm afraid. In general, what you see and what you notice from conversations, that they approve of what has happened. They approve of this, what the West calls annexation of the Crimea. This is something that touches upon an emotional issue, emotional feeling of that the Crimea has been Russian always and should be Russian. That's what many Russians, ordinary Russians, share. And that's why, on the one hand, you see these orchestrated demonstrations, what we've seen in the past few weeks, in favor of the annexation of the Crimea. But apart from that, many people genuinely feel that this is a good thing that this has happened. And whatever comes after that, whether it's sanctions from the West, problems with trade with the European Union, cutting off gas supplies to Europe, and whatever else may happen, that doesn't concern them so much.
What about the Putin critics? How vocal are they right now, and what are they saying?
Well, they're fairly silent, but of course we've seen a huge demonstration a few days ago, and it was a surprise to many people, even here in Moscow, that so many people turned out. There are various estimates from 30,000 to 50,000 to even 70,000, but at any rate, a lot of people went out into the street to protest against the annexation of the Crimea. This has been a surprise. On the other hand, you also see that within Putin's critics, there is a division. Many people support the annexation of the Crimea. They support the idea that the Crimea should become part of Russia again, and that may be a problem in the long run for the opposition in Russia. There's no sign there will be a new impetus for this anti-Putin, anti-Kremlin movement we've seen over the past few years and which all but died down before this happened.
And what role do the Russian media have in all this? Do you get a sense that they're trying to de-escalate the situation or pouring more oil on the fire?
No de-escalation whatsoever. What we've seen in the Russian media over the past, not even the past weeks, but the past months, is, I think I might say, unprecedented propaganda. It's something not only myself, but many observers, also people, Russians themselves, have said they haven't seen, well, for the past 20 years, since the late Soviet Union. It has been a very one-sided approach of what happened in Ukraine. People got the impression, many people I speak to today as well, many ordinary Russian friends of mine, They have the impression that Kiev has been all but destroyed, that it has been burned down, that it's very, very dangerous to walk around there, that there are gangs of fascists, neo-Nazis roaming the streets. And this sense of danger and this sense of fear is something you hear in discussions with Russians. You also hear it in discussions with Russians living in the Crimea, where I've been a few days ago. People are really influenced by the way the Russian media, and especially the Russian television, has covered the events in Ukraine.
Khayat, you said earlier that the people are not particularly worried about the standoff with the West, and, well, they might feel vindicated because the first round of Western sanctions only targets a small group of people, but broader economic sanctions against Russia are on the cards, and the crisis has already sent the Russian currency and stock market tumbling. What sort of impact is all this having on the everyday life of Russians, and how bad could it get?
At the moment, there is no direct impact. People are still too happy or euphorious about what has happened. We've seen a demonstration in the Red Square a few days ago where lots of people really by themselves spontaneously came to celebrate what they call the return of the Crimea to Russia. So this patriotic atmosphere will last for some time, of course, and I think it will take a few months before reality will sink in, before the effects of Western sanctions will be felt. The European Union is the biggest trade partner of Russia. Economic growth in Russia is predicted to be not more than 1% this year, which is extremely low for a developing economy like Russia's. With Western sanctions, this may get even lower, or we may enter indeed a period of stagnation. So sooner or later, Russians, ordinary Russians, will feel the effects of these sanctions, and sooner or later, questions will be asked about how this was possible and who was responsible for this. And what are we going to do with Crimea? Because Crimea, of course, is a big territory. It's a bit smaller than Belgium, and it has lots of economic problems which need to be solved. It will be very costly to keep Crimea afloat, so to speak.
Isn't it possible here that Western sanctions could have that effect of causing the support for Putin to actually grow? So the harder Russia is hit by sanctions, the more that support for Putin would grow?
In the short run, yes. So what we've seen over the past days and weeks is that Putin's popularity rating has gone up again. And one of the tactics, of course, of the Russian leadership has been for years to create the semblance of a Russia being surrounded by enemies. And this feeling, of course, will increase when Western countries will impose sanctions upon Russia.
Khayat, some analysts are concerned that all this maybe the run-up to a new era of Russian expansionism. Do you think Russians will continue to support Putin if he moves to annex more regions with ethnic Russians, such as eastern Ukraine, for instance?
Many people would applaud that, definitely, in Russia. But again, in the long run, it will be so costly that Russia just won't be able to continue this for very long, I'm afraid. I mean, all energy should be focused on preventing an economic crisis from happening in Russia. And moves like this will only increase the likelihood that Russia will enter a very long, drawn-out period of economic problems.
Journalist Khayat Rudkerkamp speaking to us from Moscow there.
Turkey is in the midst of one of the most bitter and important polls in decades. Local elections being held across the country and Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan, mired in corruption allegations, has made it a referendum on his rule. Nowhere is the campaign more intense than in Istanbul, Turkey's largest city, the Prime Minister's home and the bastion of the ruling AK Party for two decades.
But now that rule is under threat by a man equally controversial and mould-breaking as the Prime Minister, and his name is Mustafa Sarıgül. He has faced down prejudice and discrimination and is now seeking to rewrite Turkish politics. But as Dorian Jones reports from the campaign trail, he is facing an uphill battle.
İstanbul'da hukuk konuşacak. İstanbul'da benim doğrularımın dönemi bitiyor. Halkın doğrularının dönemi başlıyor.
Addressing thousands in one of Istanbul's poor neighbourhoods, Mustafa Sarıgül, with his indomitable charisma and Hollywood smile of gleaming polished white teeth, wows a crowd with promises of social justice and an end to what he called the divisive politics of the ruling AK Party, a party that has ruled Istanbul for 20 years and considers the city their own.
Orada buluşalım, saat 7'de orada buluşalım hocam, olur mu? Evet. Hadi hocam, bekliyorum hocam.
Taking a break from the campaign trail, 58-year-old Sarıgül sweeps into his office with an iron-grip handshake and exuding full confidence that he can score a landmark victory. Pausing for a moment, he acknowledges he does share something important with the man he sees as his chief rival, Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
Benim babam işçiydi, bir apartman görevlisiydi.
There are only two people in Turkish politics who have come from nothing and risen to the top, me and the Prime Minister. My father was a worker, was an apartment superintendent. I come from a working-class background and I've been in politics since I was 15.
Sarıgül, like the Prime Minister, migrated to Istanbul as a child. He also sees himself as an iconoclast. It was something he discovered in himself at an early age.
Ben fakir bir ailenin çocuğuydum ve
coming from a poor family, we, the poor children, were always placed at the back of the classroom. I started thinking, why am I sitting in the back row, while the rich ones get to sit in the front? I started organizing the kids in the back rows and kept challenging those in the front. In the fourth grade of primary school, we held a symbolic mayoral election, and I won, with the support of the back rows. I was elected mayor by just one vote. Fighting against injustice motivates me.
Fighting is something that comes as second nature to Sarıgül. The party conference of the center-left People's Republican Party, or CHP, held some years ago, ended in a mass brawl, with Sarıgül supporters fighting with delegates of the leader in a challenge for the leadership. That saw him expelled. But he stood for election for a rival party and won as a local mayor in Istanbul. That victory eventually paved his way to return to the main opposition CHP and become their candidate for Istanbul. But some detractors still accuse him of roughhouse tactics and coming from the wrong side of the track. Sarıgül says Turkish politics, like wider society, is still dominated by class, even in his own party.
Çok zor yaşam hakkı vermiyorlar. Seçkinler var, elitler var, yaşam hakkı vermiyorlar.
There are elites that don't give the same rights to those people who are from another class. This is a problem today in our society. They don't have faith in people like me, but I succeeded. I fought to prove them wrong. When I first stood as candidate for parliament, as the country's youngest candidate, there were all these former ministers against me. But I won the nomination with the support of the ordinary members and became the country's youngest member of parliament at 30.
Alın teri emeğe de ihtiyaç var, üretime de ihtiyaç var. Yeter ki.
Allahümme salli ala seyyidina Muhammedin ve ala.
Sarıgül is not only challenging his party's elitist reputation, but also offering a new take on religion. The CHP portrays itself as defender of the secular state. Until recently, they supported restrictions on the wearing of religious headscarves by Muslim women. The ruling AK party, which is Islamist-rooted, has been successful in portraying its rival as anti-Muslim, a serious handicap in a conservative society like Turkey. But Sarıgül is a new breed of center-left politician.
I am from a devout family, but I'm close to all religious communities living here. I visited the churches, the synagogues. Everyone knows my stance toward religion. For prayer, I go to small, unknown mosques across the city so as to avoid the media. I don't want my faith to be part of politics. Faith is for reaching God, not power. The Prime Minister is using religion for just that.
Çok mütevazi, hiç kimsenin görmeyeceği camilere gidiyorum ki demeçlerine istismar ediyor.
Bir kez daha sandıklarda hile yaparak İstanbul'a alırlarsa.
Sarıgül is at home in both religious and secular neighborhoods of Istanbul, and according to several polls, is neck and neck with the ruling AK party. And it seems the Prime Minister is worried.
Zatla ilgili yani yayın politikalarını, televizyonlardaki yayın politikaları yani bayağı şey diyor yani.
A recording, allegedly, of Prime Minister Erdogan telling a media boss to stop reporting on Sarıgül. The boss apologizes and promises to comply. Sarıgül has become largely invisible in much of the media, but he says he has far more important concerns.
Sayın Başbakan kendisi gibi düşünmeyen herkesi düşman ilan ediyor.
The Prime Minister has turned this into a blood feud between brothers. Even our offices have been attacked. Unfortunately, I don't believe this election will be fair. We know they're creating all these fake votes. They're registering Syrian refugees to vote. That's why we're calling for international observers from the Council of Europe. But I'm sure our citizens will show their democratic credentials. But it's fighting for people's rights that drives me.
Bir sürü insanları kaydetmeye başladılar.
Sarı dille gönüllerde olmaya geldi. Türkiye, Türkiye sevdalarıyla.
The ruling AK party strongly denies such charges. With such accusations and concerns going viral across the city, few people are expecting Sarıgül to give up without a fight in his battle to become mayor of Istanbul.
That report was by Dorian Jones in Istanbul. We now move to France, where a certain group of people no longer feel welcome. According to statistics recently published by the Jewish Agency, 3,120 French Jews moved to Israel last year. Now, that may not sound like a lot, but it's a sharp increase of 63% on the previous year.
And Israel, whose population recently surpassed 8 million, says they expect more and more French-Jewish émigrés to arrive over the next few years. One of the main reasons cited by those leaving France is rising anti-Semitism. In Paris, John Lawrenson reports.
Paris 2014, supporters of the stand-up comic Dieudonné demonstrate alongside far-right nationalists. They shout slogans against an enemy they call the Zionists. Dieudonné Mbala Mbala, condemned on several occasions for inciting hatred against Jews, has just had his show The Wall banned. It contained a so-called joke about a Jewish radio presenter where Dieudonné regretted he hadn't died in the gas chambers. Benjamin, a young man of North African origin, is one of Dieudonné's supporters.
Can I ask you why you're here today?
I'm here to defend expression liberty.
Why do you think that liberty of expression is threatened?
Because kind of lobbies make pressure on media and on the government to make the voice of the people shut down, shut up.
Which lobbies?
Huh?
What lobbies?
The main one in France, the most powerful. Its name is CRIF, C-R-I-F.
The Jewish Representative Organization. The Jewish Representative Organization.
That's right.
You think they're very powerful?
They are the most powerful lobby in France.
More powerful than the labor unions, say, or the Employers' Confederation, or the farmers, or the Catholic Church. Further on, I meet a woman yelling, "Ananas, pineapple." Indeed, many of the demonstrators are carrying pineapples, in homage to a Dieudonné song called "Show Ananas, Holocaust Pineapple."
We have to tell to the whole world that France is like Israel. We can't say anything today, okay? When we talk about Israel, we are antisemites, and this is false.
But isn't the Shoah Nanas song, isn't that just an anti-Semitic song?
No.
But it's just making fun of the Holocaust,
yes,
this song.
Yes, of course, yes.
And that's not anti-Semitic?
No, like the Kennel. Kennel is not anti-Semite. Le Kennel, c'est anti-system, monsieur. C'est un anti-système. We are fed up with the government.
The so-called Kennel arm gesture Dieudonné invented looks like a lowered Heil Hitler salute. The French international football player Nicolas Anelka was fined and suspended for a number of matches for doing a Kennel after scoring in an English Premiership game. More proof, says Dieudonné, of the power of the Jewish lobby. The Kennel, says Dieudonné, is nothing but an up-yours gesture with no anti-Semitic overtones. But French Jews have good reason to doubt this.
My name is Salomé Roussel. I'm 38 years old and I live in Paris. I was in the metro after a party and then a guy saw me, make a smile, see my Stars of David here on my neck. And he made me a Kennel. I don't know how to say it in English.
He made this Kennel gesture to you?
Yep.
Dieudonné and others say that this is just an anti-system gesture, it's not an anti-Semitic gesture.
Yes, but I've got Stars of David, and I'm Jew, and I'm not the system. So the question is, why?
So it's clear to you that this is an anti-Semitic gesture?
For me, yes. Because when you do this on a memorial of Shoah or in front of Anne Frank plaque or Jewish school, it's not against the system.
There's been an increase in the number of French Jews leaving France for Israel. What do you think about that? Is that something that you wonder about doing?
I'm French. I was born in Paris, and I think about the possibility to move in Israel because French people are more and more against the Jew. This is a lobby, and
they say that there's a Jewish lobby, you
yep.
mean? Yeah.
And we are the master of the world, and it's not. Hmm. So
this is just a minority of French people who say these things.
Perhaps, but the air is special. People say that Jewish people are can't laugh about nothing, are always the victim. Perhaps I will be great in Israel. I don't know.
How do you think things would be different in Israel?
Because this is Jew state. So you can be Jew, no big deal. You have other problem, but not this one.
In the back of his car, as a bodyguard keeps a wary eye on the Parisian street around us, I catch up with the lawyer and former head of the French Sons and Daughters of Deportees Association, Arnaud Klarsfeld, as he talks on the phone to his father, the so-called Nazi hunter Serge Klarsfeld, who was responsible for a string of arrests of people who collaborated with the deportation to the Nazi death camps of some 80,000 French Jews. Arnaud Klarsfeld called for demonstrations in front of theatres where Dieudonné was performing. In turn, Dieudonné said Klarsfeld should watch out because he was going to get, I quote, his little face of a little apartment pussycat kicked in. Klarsfeld is on the front line of what he sees as a battle against a new wave of French anti-Semitism coming from a part of France's large Muslim population, which is pushing Jews to leave the country.
It is obvious that if the incitement against Jews continues, the Jews will leave. Most Jews have already left the suburbs because the climate isn't very good for the Jews in the suburbs.
What do you mean by that?
Some, at least Arabs, are very much against the Jews. There's violence at school. A Jew who wears the kippah in the suburbs will not last very long. When a teacher speaks about the Shoah in class, he's a lot of pupils from Arab descent are not happy and make some derogatory remarks. So in certain parts of France, it is difficult to be Jew. Most of the Arabs are not anti-Semitic, but a certain percentage is. And with shows like the one of Dieudonné, they have tendency to become more and more.
The Jewish agency says they expect 40,000 more French Jews to leave France for Israel over the next few years.
John Lawrenson reporting from Paris there.
You're listening to DW's World Link, where I'm Neil King.
And I'm Samantha Early.
This is DW's WorldLink, bringing you the personal stories behind the headlines. In Bonn, I'm Neil King.
And I'm Samantha Early. Still to come, a campaign to end global slavery, and we examine how men are coming to terms with changing gender roles.
And a woman from New York City shares her struggle to visit her baby daughter's final resting place.
She was not indigent. She was not poor. She was not unwanted. She was not a criminal to be in the criminal justice system. It was a real travesty of justice for this to happen to me and to many, many other people.
Elaine Joseph's story and more coming up on WorldLink.
This week, the so-called Global Freedom Network was launched in the Vatican. This new interreligious initiative, backed by the Roman Catholic and Anglican churches, as well as high-ranking leaders of the Muslim Sunni faith, aims to eradicate slavery around the globe. The initiative is the brainchild of the Australian billionaire, mining magnate and philanthropist Andrew Forrest, who in 2012 created a precursor organisation, the Walk Free Foundation.
The new interreligious initiative, launched in Rome, has defined its key objectives as getting the G20 to condemn modern-day slavery, persuade 50 major corporations to rid their supply chains of slavery, and convince 160 governments to endorse a $100 million fundraising drive to implement anti-slavery measures globally. Earlier, I spoke to Gina Dafalia in Perth, Australia, who's a researcher with the Walk Free Foundation, responsible for the Global Slavery Index. I started by asking her what inspired Forrest to take up the fight against slavery in the first place.
Andrew Forrest was visiting his daughter, who was traveling at the time and working in Nepal at an orphanage. And she was very much involved in helping children there, and she decided to bring her parents along to visit the orphanage. And when Andrew and Nicola, his wife, went to visit, they discovered to their horror that the children in the orphanage were sold into sexual exploitation. And they decided that that was horrible and went against their values. So when Andrew Forrest returned to Australia, he decided that he needed to have a look at his own business operations of his company, which is one of the largest iron ore companies in the world, called Fortescue Metal Group. And he discovered, again, in horror, that he also had slavery in his own supply chains and actively put policies and procedures in place to tackle it. And he also went a step further in that the suppliers that were using slave labor, he used his influence and his leverage to make them stop those practices. But that wasn't enough. He wanted to mobilize global movement. He wanted to create a movement where slavery would be abolished.
So given the research you've conducted with the Walk Free Foundation, how severe and diversified is the problem of slavery these days? Can you perhaps give us some examples?
Yeah, so surprisingly, many people think that slavery was abolished many, many years ago, but it still exists, and it still exists in every single country in the world. And we, from the research that we did, we estimate that there are nearly 30 million slaves around the world. About 72% of them are actually in Asia, but every single country has them. There are different types of slavery. There is bonded labor, there is domestic servitude, there's trafficking of human beings, and there are worse forms of child labor and also forced marriage. All of these we consider as forms of slavery. And the way we define slavery is the deprivation of a person's freedom for personal and commercial exploitation.
This week, we saw the launch of the Global Freedom Network in Italy. How does this new initiative tie into the Walk Free Foundation?
There are a lot of very good initiatives that are taking place around the world, and we've got partners all around the world that help us carry out these initiatives. But we realized that there was something missing and that we needed a joined-up effort from highly influential religious leaders to really mobilize action at a global level. Last November, Andrew Forrest was invited to a workshop at the Vatican. As a lot of people are aware, Pope Francis is very much concerned about the situation of modern slavery. And during this workshop, they identified one of the action points was having a network of leaders from different religions to take this agenda forward and to really create a vast global mobilization to end slavery. And we decided at the Walk Free Foundation that this is an opportunity to take this forward and that we needed to absolutely create this network. And Andrew Forrest used his personal connections within the different religious communities and for the first time brought together the Catholic Church, the Anglican Church, and the Islamic Sunni faith to work together to join their forces and to work on a very concrete project, which is to end slavery.
So what's the next step? Where does this anti-slavery alliance go from here?
The first step is this is not a static group. It's an ever-expanding network. So we're hoping, and we've approached different other faiths like Judaism, and we've also approached the Orthodox churches to join in this effort as well. So the Global Freedom Network hopes that in a year's time, the network will grow to include more faith leaders. And what they're going to start doing is start working in countries where they have very large communities. Where there's a country with slavery, there's a church or there's a temple or there's a mosque. So the first thing that they're going to start doing is educating and raising awareness on slavery within those communities. The second thing that they will do is leverage their influence. Religious leaders are very influential in many countries to put slavery on the policy agenda and make sure that it stays in the political agenda and that they're putting pressure on government leaders to make sure that the right policies are in place. And obviously, churches, mosques, and temples, they also have a huge role in terms of working and helping to support survivors and people who have been rescued. So they'll have a large role to play in putting those support systems in place for people who are leaving slavery.
That was Gina DeFaglia, researcher for the Walk Free Foundation, talking to me from Perth, Australia.
Picture this. 1 million dead bodies buried in makeshift wooden caskets since 1869. The homeless, poor and stillborn delivered by truck and ferry every week for unceremonious internment by inmates from a local prison. Trenches 10 feet deep and as long as a football field full of rotting corpses. The relatives never allowed to visit their resting place on a windswept island.
Surely that's what happened in the 19th century or in the midst of a war or a famine or a rather poor country, I'd say.
Actually, Neil, this is New York City in 2014. Hart Island, a 100-acre strip of land a short boat ride from the Bronx, is New York's Potter's Field, a term used for an area where the unclaimed dead are buried, either because their relatives can't be reached or identified, they can't afford a funeral, or for some other reason opt for what's known as a city burial. For many years, the mothers of infants buried on Hart Island have been fighting the city, in court and the press, for visitation rights. And last Friday, Elaine Joseph became the first to see her daughter's grave. Andrew Purcell went to meet her.
I just thought of this the other day. This is my baby's footprints and my thumbprint to indicate that this is... She was here. She was really here. She was born. And she died.
And there it is. This certifies, let me see.
It certifies.
This certifies that Tomika Mack was born to Elaine Lemchuk and William Mack at 4:48 a.m. on Monday, the 16th day of January, 1978. And it's from the Beth Israel Medical Center in New York.
Tomika was born severely premature during a huge snowstorm that shut down New York. She needed emergency heart surgery, and after being transferred from one hospital to another, she died in the operating theatre while her mother lay stranded several miles away in Brooklyn. By the time Elaine could get someone on the phone at the hospital to discuss her daughter's burial, it was too late.
I called back during the week several times, couldn't reach anybody. By the time I did reach someone, they said, "Well, you already signed." I said, "Sign what?" They said that I signed to have the baby buried by the city and that I shouldn't worry about it because she'd be buried with babies and stillborns. And it's okay.
Elaine didn't have much time to search for her daughter, or time to grieve. 5 months later, her husband was killed. Soon afterwards, she discovered that she was pregnant again with his child. She never forgot Tamika, but life moved on. It was only in 2009 that she discovered that her daughter was buried on Hart Island, and ever since she's been fighting for the right to visit her grave. Twice the authorities allowed her onto the island, but, in common with all the other relatives of the island's dead, she was never permitted to see the burial site itself.
It has been 36 years that I've been waiting to make a visit to the gravesite of my daughter. Since there have been so many mix-ups and mishaps, I didn't know what was going to happen. But my expectation was to see a burial ground where essentially my daughter was buried. And I didn't know what it looked like, even though I had been to the island a couple of other times, because the previous times I was only able to stand at a gazebo, which is on the opposite side of the island. And from that gazebo, you have no idea that there is a cemetery there. All you can see is a few trees.
So was it different this time?
Absolutely. Very different. Completely different. I was able to walk on the island to the site of the mass burials for babies.
There at the site where her daughter was buried, alongside another 1,000 stillborn babies and infants who didn't survive, someone had lain flowers.
I didn't start to cry until I saw that. It was a huge field that had just been recently cleared away, it looked like, and it was an ugly field. And in the midst of this ugly field was a bouquet of flowers. And as I was walking up, I said to my son, I said, wow, somebody was here. Somebody put flowers there. And it was that the Captain Thompson, who is the Department of Corrections personnel in charge of Rikers Island, he put the flowers there personally. And when I saw this, that I broke down crying because it showed humanity.
I was astonished to find out about this story. The idea that a mass grave like that could exist in New York City. Do you think people are aware that this goes on?
Absolutely not. I am a native New Yorker. I've been born and raised in New York City. I didn't know it existed. I had no idea it was there. And whenever I ask people, native New Yorkers, do you know where the city's public cemetery is, or do you know about Hart Island? They all say no.
Elaine wasn't allowed to take flowers herself. She wasn't allowed to bring a reporter along or video her visit. Visitors to the island must turn over their mobile phones and other personal possessions at the dock. This is largely because Hart Island is run by New York's Corrections Department. The graves are dug by inmates at Rikers Island Prison, earning 50 cents an hour. Alan Olson was one of them.
I was in 5 months in Hart Island, and I buried well over 700 bodies. And that's not even, you know, going to say babies. Because babies would come once a week, 40 or 50, and now it's just, you know, it's just a little box.
That last clip is from a film documentary about Hart Island, made by Melinda Hunt. From 1991 to 1994, she interviewed prisoners working there for an art project that has, over the years, become something close to her life's work.
While they were performing the burial, it was like they became the priests. They were like saying prayers, and there was a kind of formality that the inmates were introducing. They created a ceremony for it. Even though the prison guards were just standing there and not doing anything, the inmates, you could see, were very attached to this process.
Hunt founded the Hart Island Project, which campaigns for the fields to be converted into parkland and the burial ground open to the public. Previous Potter's Fields in New York are protected sites, including City Hall Park, Bryant Park, and Madison Square Park, all in Midtown Manhattan.
There was such a hopefulness in going to Hart Island. This is why I want it to be a park. I know there's opposition to it because it seems like it's a very dark place. But when you go there, and it's this wide open, beautiful landscape, and scattered around the island were these little makeshift memorials created by the inmates.
The Hart Island Project has built an online database of over 60,000 burials from 1980 to 2011. Hunt is personally in touch with hundreds of families and has accompanied several over to the island, sometimes in the company of a priest, but never until last Friday to the gravesite itself.
Lord, we thank you for the life of your servants who have been taken from us and who rest in graves in this place. May they know the fullness of peace, and may we who mourn them be at peace. We seek your blessing in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.
There is a right to visit the grave. The state can't just disappear people into a mass grave. The right to bury one's relatives, inherent to that is a right to return to that grave site. You're not agreeing to a burial within a prison when you agree to a city burial.
The city opted not to contest the Heart Island Project's lawsuit on behalf of the eight women and says they will all be allowed to visit. It has mapped the trenches using GPS technology and opened up its own database for the people buried there dating back to 1977, searchable by first or last name, age, gender or year of death. Tamika Mack is not in it. The records for 1978 were lost or destroyed.
She was not indigent. She was not poor. She was not unwanted. She was not a criminal to be in the criminal justice system. It was a real travesty of justice for this to happen to me and to many, many other people.
Elaine Joseph there, ending her story, which was brought to us by Andrew Purcell.
The changing roles of men and women in modern society was the inspiration for Spanish photographer John Uriarte, who spent 3 years creating portraits of men wearing the clothes of their wife or girlfriend, photographed in the homes they share.
The project is called The Men Under the Influence, and in another sign of the times, it's gained wide exposure online, with the photos being shared through news and social media. We began by asking John how he got the idea.
It all started when I was living in New York, and I remember talking to some of my friends there, talking about their own relationships with their girlfriends, and how we, the men, sometimes felt kind of like lost because the references from our parents and the relationships of our parents were different from ours. I think that was the starting point because we saw that like maybe the balance on the relationships had changed in the last generation.
How would you say, John, that the balance has changed? I mean, you're in your early 30s yourself, right? So you relate to these experiences mm-hmm. too.
We are not used to be related to women who finally that kind of freedom. It's a good thing. It's good that I'm happy to see that they are much more free and have more social possibilities. But at the same time, on relationships, there's something that we are not used to the men. So that's what I was trying to show with the project. I mean, it's not a big drama. It's not something really bad or this kind of things. It's just a feeling that I thought that it was interesting to think on.
John, I imagine these photo shoots must have been quite hilarious. I imagine you were cracking up quite often laughing with your subject, but they actually look rather sad in the pictures or maybe even lost. How deliberate was that?
It was really fun to take the pictures because all of them are friends of mine or friends of friends or people who I had around. Most of the time the women, their girlfriends were there too, so there was like a really funny and friendly like feeling during the shoots. But my goal was to transmit that sense of like feeling lost or something like that on those relationships. So the funny faces didn't work for me. I mean, I needed something much more serious. So when I was taking the photos, I asked some like intimate questions about their relationships. So they started to change their faces. When you see one photo of these men with the clothes of their girlfriends, it's not about that particular man and his particular relationship. It's much more about like a much more open idea or abstract idea.
So is that idea sort of emasculation in a way?
Emasculation, yeah, something like that. That could be a good description, yeah.
John, your photos, they've gone pretty viral in the internet. What sort of reactions have you been getting to this project?
It's been really crazy how viral when this project, because I finished this project like 4 or 5 years ago. And suddenly, last summer, I don't know what happens, it started in one blog or one website, and it went all around the world. And there's been like many different reactions. I have received many emails from like all the gay and lesbian communities, like, you know, wanting to show the project on their websites, magazines, and these kind of things. I would say I received emails from all over the world. For instance, there was an Italian guy who sent me an email with photos of himself wearing the clothes of his girlfriend. Received emails saying thank you. I received emails saying that they don't like my project, and I have written thousands of comments on different websites and blogs. It's been really interesting, and sometimes it opened some discussions about gender, about relationships nowadays, and these kind of things, which was my goal. So I'm really happy with the results and the comments.
That was Spanish photographer John Uriarte talking to us about his project, The Men Under the Influence.
And sticking with men, we're about to meet a pair of teenagers who have committed their lives to grueling physical work. Hours of training, conditioning and study, all in pursuit of the perfect pirouette.
David and Michael are students at Berlin State Ballet Academy. Correspondent Leah McDonnell visited them to find out what makes a modern young man in this day and age choose a career in classical dance.
It's 6 in the evening at the State Ballet School of Berlin. The intense training offered here is excellent preparation for the tireless life of a professional dancer. The main dance studio is a huge mirrored space the size of a large stage. 19-year-old David from Spain is rehearsing under the watchful eyes of his teachers. He joined the school a year ago, surrendering himself to the rigorous physical regime required to become a professional ballet dancer.
5 years ago, I decided this is my life. I think the dance, it's the part of the person, and it's the form for express your all. It's one part of me, and yeah, I think it's for this I decide dance.
Ballet is a classical dance form with its origins in the antiquated social dances of Europe's royal courts. Now it's the technical foundation of all other concert dance and pushes the body to its physical limits. Flexibility, strength, musicality, perseverance, all are needed to master this demanding performing art. And that means endless practice and sore muscles. When 18-year-old Michael from Bulgaria also joined the school last year, he still had doubts.
At the beginning, I wasn't sure if I really want to do this because it was really hard. So if I want to spend all my life doing ballet, I should be prepared for all the injuries and stuff. But after all, I decided to continue with ballet because I really like to dance. And even if I don't dance ballet after, I can still do neoclassic or something else, but will be dance.
Olaf Höfer has been teaching at the school for 27 years and knows what it takes to make it in the dance world.
This is a really hard job, and sometimes the young people, they really want to do this, and after a while, some of them, they start to think, I can have it easier if I do another job.
Both David and Michael have impressed him with their rapid development and work ethic.
They have really the right heart to be a dancer because they understand how nice it is to work hard. They are really talented. Michael, he's a mover. He's a totally mover. He has a nice body. His body is very intelligent. The body knows what he has to do. And he developed himself in this short time here in the school. That's amazing. And for me, what I really special like on him, he's a good partner for the girls.
Which Michael does as if it's the most natural thing in the world, to lift a girl over your head or catch her in midair from split leap. As for David, Olaf Höfer says he's a natural performer who comes alive on stage.
David is totally different to Michael. David is, first of all, an actor. He has a nice body, too. He can tell you over a distance, like 20, 15 meters, his story with his body, with his face, with his fingers, with his energy in his body. This is really good. But it's not just this. He's also a good dancer. He is a good turner.
What is it that makes some people want to dance or need to express themselves in some artistic way? Is it genetic? Not for David, who says there are no artists in his family. Both his mother and father drive taxis. Still, they supported his decision to pursue a career in dance, even if they don't understand it themselves.
My mother saying me, I don't know why you like dance, because, yeah, when I listen to music, it's automatic. My legs and my foot automatic move. My mother and my father saying me, it's your life, and your life, it's for you, and you decide.
Early on, Mikhail was also afflicted with a bad case of happy feet.
When I was 12 years old, I was dancing the whole time different kind of dances, and I was doing different kind of movements. So my teacher at the school proposed to my mother that she should take me somewhere that I can express myself or I should dance. So they brought me to a ballet school.
After getting accepted by the State Ballet School of Berlin last year, Mikhail left his family home in Varna, Bulgaria, to train seriously in the German capital. And with his parents' blessings.
They said, go and chase your dream. We cannot stop you, because if you want to do this, you have to do it. They were supporting me the whole time.
In Berlin, Mikhail feels right at home. So does David. Here, they're not alone in their foreignness. In fact, the school is full of students from all over the world. Brazil, Japan, Russia, France, China, Italy, to name a few. Olaf Höfer enjoys the harmonious multicultural atmosphere, but says the reason for the school's large foreign enrollment is simply a lack of domestic talent.
That is really a big problem for us, to find talented people. And this is what I feel in the last 10, 20 years. The bodies are not so good anymore. They don't move so good anymore, because they sit on a computer. They eat different to the years before. When I was a young kid, we played on the street. We was outside. We was jumping and running and doing like that. It's really funny. Sometimes we tell the kids, they are 10, and we ask them, can you do a cartwheel? And they can't do this. It was impossible in my time.
Both Mikhail and David seem to have an intuitive sense of and ability for classical movement. While others struggle to master the steps and moves, it seems to come to them almost naturally, as if they were remembering something once forgotten, rather than learning something new. In person, the boys appear to be like any other normal European teen, with one exception. You won't find them with their noses buried in cell phones or tablets. David says serious young dance professionals like him have no time for Facebook or Twitter or any other forms of virtual living.
I think all my friends in this moment, it's only dancer people, don't have too much time for look the computer. I stay all day in the school. And
here at the ballet school, the communication tool grabbing all the attention is the physical body and mastering its abilities. Students are very aware that funding for the arts is limited and global competition is getting tougher all the time. However, says Olaf Höfer,
if you are a really good dancer, you will find a job. You have to be good.
And that's just what David and Mikhail plan to be. Good. Really good. At a young age, both have committed themselves to a very risky career that offers no job security. Only the peace of mind that comes with knowing you're following your heart.
If you just like doing something, you just keep doing it because it's your life. You can decide for yourselves. And if you do all the time something that you don't want to do, you will feel always bad. So just express yourself and do something that you love.
A professional dance career is certainly not for everyone. Still, you have to admire these young men for their dreams, discipline, and commitment to their craft.
Leah McDonald brought us that story from Berlin.
And that just about wraps up this week's show. Worldlink was produced by Gert Georgi, Neil King, Samantha Early and Nancy Isenson. And don't forget, if you'd like to hear any of the items featured on today's programme again, go to dw.de/worldlink or look us up on iTunes. Worldlink is brought to you by DW in Bonn.